Empire podcast this week, we cover ourselves an awful to talk to The Walking Dead's Greg Nicotero and Norman Reedus. And if that weren't enough, the man mountain that is Carl Weathers drops by for a chat. No arm wrestling in mind. All that and the usual news and nonsense on the movie podcast that is trying not to make any references to a certain cooking show that returned this week. Podcast intros don't get any tougher than this. Hello, Pod. I'm Chris Hewitt, and welcome to the Empire Podcast, brought to you by those lovable insurance comparison chaps at mustard.co.uk. This week, Helen O'Hara is off beginning her preparation for her insane odyssey running up a mountain in Nepal. So it's a full-on swinging sausage fest around here. A sausage fest cooked in an onion gravy with salsify, onion petals.
What?
And a white wine shoe. No. No more MasterChef references. First up is our art house guru, a man whose favourite John Ford Western isn't The Searchers, it isn't Rio Bravo, but it is To Road Together. Sorry, To Road Together, not To John To Road Together. Anyway, it's Phil Dissemblian.
Yeah, hi. That was awful.
I wasn't sure people got that.
They did.
Yeah, to Road. John to
they
Road.
Did. They're trying to get
he's
over.
On Master.
You're interrupting their healing process.
Next up is our George Harrison lookalike, the quiet poddle, whose favourite Matt Damon film is the recent epic, The Greg Wallace. I mean, The Great Wall. It's John Nugent.
That's gross. Man.
Hi, I think.
Hello. How are you?
I'm still getting over what can barely be described as a pun. I don't know.
Well, I was looking for films with Wall that I could change to Wallace, right?
Mm, yeah, no, we understand.
And
the
then,
logic.
And then
yeah.
I can,
you
I
don't need to explain it.
There was a film called The Great Wall.
That's not what I was asking.
And Greg, great.
I'm hearing this, this gag is playing well in China.
It makes perfect
not so
sense.
Well, not so well in Europe.
Okay, enough MasterChef nonsense. It is time for this week's question, and this comes via Twitter from @LaeStadius15. L-A-E Stadius. LaeStadius15. And they ask, what are the best, most fitting end credit songs? They should be, and this is important to you guys, they should be integral to the film. All three Lord of the Rings rank highly, Imo, says LaeStadius15. So there you go. So, not just end credit songs. You can't just stick a song on the end credits so it can climb up the charts. It has to have some thematic link to the movie, or it has to emerge from the movie. For example, yesterday I had the good fortune to watch The Time of Their Lives, starring Dame Joan Collins, and there's a motif. Phil, have you seen this film?
No.
You interviewed Dame Joan Collins.
Yeah, I did.
You asked her how hairy her ass was, didn't you? Did you do that?
I'm incredibly hairy, as it turned out.
Did you?
No, I didn't ask her.
Okay.
That would be
okay.
She's a dame. I can't ask her that.
You can.
I asked her what the worst man in the world was.
And what was it?
Her neighbours. Which is the most Dave Joe Collins answer ever.
Wow.
Pete Collins.
Well, so there's this film, The Time of Our Lives, which Joan Collins stars alongside Pauline Collins. And Franco
and
Nero.
John Collins, ex of self.
John Collins, yeah. And Franco Nero's in it. And,
yeah, that's really weird.
He has a full frontal nude scene in which you see his Francos and his Beanos, which I was not expecting.
His Django's.
In this.
Django's fully unchained.
I can't believe you let the Django one go. You're an amateur.
I'm not an amateur.
You are.
Vote for us in the British Podcast Awards. Listener's choice. Voting is still open right now. Oh, God. People are going, Helen has been gone for 5 minutes.
We've had 59 euphemisms for penis.
Yeah, already we're talking about Franco Nero's wobbly knob, which I did not expect to see in this film, The Time of Their Lives.
No.
But suddenly there it is, and it's unavoidable. And thankfully not in 3D. He's got a lot to be proud of. Let's just put it that way and leave it at that. Anyway, there's a song that runs throughout the film. I'm not saying this is my choice, but I'm just saying, as by way of illustration, there's a song that runs through the film, a motif called Morty and Me, which I believe was co-written by Tim Rice, the executive producer of the film. And then at the end of the film, you hear the full song, Morty and Me, sung by no less than Sophie Ellis-Bextor.
That's ridiculous. I thought you were about to say sort of Pavarotti or something.
Well, that'd be a turn up for the books, wouldn't it?
Well, no, okay, so a bad example. But, I mean, wow. Wow. I don't know if that's probably answered the question. No less than Sophia.
Luminary.
Oh, going back to The Hobbit.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
They're all quite... You could argue that some of them go too far. They're too thematically linked to the film.
Right.
The Ed Sheeran one, I give you. The lyrics are like, icy fire, burning the trees.
Uh-huh.
Fuck off, dragon, scorching those leaves. Now I see fire lighting that thatch. What do you know? It's Benedict Cumberbatch. I think that's the lyric. I can't remember exactly.
Did Sheeran do
on those lines?
He did the third one, didn't he?
Second one.
He did the second one.
First one was.
Well, the first one I like.
First one you like, of course, because it's Neil Finn
and it's a lovely ditty, and he actually mentions the lonely song of the lonely mountain, and you know, it's a very lovely, almost a folk song. Far over the misty mountains rise.
Yeah, that was.
I'm just saying that you could sing it in that way.
I close my eyes and I'm literally in Middle Earth right now.
You were singing this in the office yesterday, and it did sound like you're on helium or something, like a helium folk song.
The misty mountains. That's a lovely song. Lovely song. It's great.
Mm-hmm.
Good old Neil Finn.
Good one,
Neil Finn.
That's a good one. And then obviously second one we've had Sheeran, we've talked about.
So who's the third?
Billy Boyd.
Billy Boyd.
Billy Boyd.
Billy Boyd.
Five Armies, is it called?
Wow.
I believe.
I've been quite
Would
good.
It be wrong of me not to mention We Fight for Love by Power Station?
Oh, that was on my list.
God. From the end credits of Commando.
Of course.
Yeah.
Because that's what he's doing. He's literally fighting for love.
It's incredibly relevant.
With a massive bazooka.
Is that the one that goes somewhere, somehow? Is that the one?
Something like that.
Yeah, something
it's
like that.
It's a classic Power Station riff.
And that's actually the tagline of the film. Somewhere, somehow, someone's going to pay. But I don't think that's the lyric in the song. But there's a refrain that goes through that song, which is interesting. Mm.
Yeah. That's really relevant if it's on the poster as well.
Yeah.
It's a lyrical spoiler.
If we're thinking about exit music for a film, what could be more relevant than
Mad World by Gary Jules?
Where are you going with this, John?
Well, you seem to have cottoned on to my devious scheme. Exit music for a film by Radiohead, which was written specifically for Baz Luhrmann's Romeo and Juliet.
I think you find it's Baz Luhrmann's William Shakespeare's Romeo and Juliet.
Okay, yeah.
Or is it William Shakespeare's Baz Luhrmann? Anyway, it's Romeo and Juliet.
Pretty sure Shakespeare wrote that one. I don't think it was Baz Luhrmann's original story. But that's literally exit music for a film.
But the lyrics, do the lyrics pertain to the situation?
I don't know. It's all
Romeo.
Sad, isn't it? It's all Radiohead.
It's all sad.
It's all just bleak.
What do you remember
miserable.
Of the lyrics, Chris?
I don't remember much of the lyrics.
Beep, beep, boop, beep, beep, beep. No, that's their Bond theme.
Human pigs, Billy Boy, don't eat mommy. Beep, beep, boop, boop, boop.
When you park the car,
Oh, I've got my ticket. That sort of thing. It's a great song. It's a great song.
It's a good song. We all remember it.
There's a song at the end of the film Class of 1984. I think I've talked about it in the podcast before, because we've had a variation of this question in the past.
Well, the football documentary.
That's Class of 1992. Oh. Class of 1984 is an ultra-violent movie directed, weirdly enough, by the director of Commando, Mark L. Lester, and written by Tom Holland. Not Spider-Man. Not The Historian. Not even...
There's like seven of them.
Not James Dyer's roofer, but the writer and director of Fright Night and Child's Play. And it's about a really schlocky, really ultra-violent film about with a young Michael J. Fox, credited as Michael Fox, no J.
Wow.
And it's about a teacher who goes to a school, inner city school, and there he finds some inner city pressure, and he runs into a group of kids who are just horrible, nasty shits, and at the end he goes nuts and kills them all. But the film, I believe, and someone's going to correct me on this, is bookended with an Alice Cooper song with the lyrics are, "When does a dream become a nightmare?" And you're thinking, Alice, you've hit the nail on the head here, mate. You've absolutely gone to the thematic core of this film. When does a dream? This new job helping young kids, like helping a young, fresh-faced Michael Fox, fulfill his potential. Right. Become a nightmare when a group of punks are coming at you with a buzzsaw. That's That's
it. It's pretty profound.
It's profound.
Yeah. Considering until 2 minutes ago, I thought this was a film involving Nicky Butt and Paul Scholes.
Well, for me,
when does a dream become an omen? There must be a point in the movie where that happens.
Oh, for me, it's whenever they win against Bayern Munich in 1999 and that night in Barcelona and fluke the treble. But anyway, that's neither here nor there.
Fair enough. What about dum dum?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Ferris Bueller.
Ferris Bueller.
Sorry, that's Phil's cue for sexy time as well. Sorry.
You got mixed up.
Yeah, really.
You misread the signals.
I did.
Those lyrics.
Yellow. From
very,
the end of
very relevant.
Ferris Bueller.
What are the lyrics?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that really sums up the movie, don't you think?
Yeah. Not really. No. It's not lyrically. it's not lyrically doing a lot, is it? But it does sum up his kind of, you know, devil may care. No, there's really no thematic relevance for that one, but I like it. So there. More thematically relevant, The Pixies' Where Is My Mind from the end, of course, of Fight Club, which is a classic.
Oh, yeah.
Classic choice.
Where is his mind indeed?
Where is his mind?
Yes.
Don't know.
Don't know. It's ephemeral. No one can see it. That's a really good one. I like Wake Up at the end of The Matrix.
Yeah.
Again, a bit on the nose, but you know, it's fine. Yeah. And it's a cracking track by Rage Against the Machine. So
I've got actually quite a long list here. Should we just bash through them and you can just make noises?
Shall I pull the curtain back a little bit on how this podcast is recorded?
No.
No?
It's magic.
I want to.
Don't. Everyone knows anyway, like they know that we don't do a lot of preparation. We don't give it a lot of thought.
Is it that obvious?
We sneak it in between.
Well, it's just because various reasons we had to postpone the recording of this podcast until Friday morning, which is a good thing because there's some news appropriately that we want to talk about. And normally we do it on a Thursday morning or a Thursday afternoon. And I came in this morning and I came in late and we didn't have a lot of time because I had to run off somewhere. And these two guys were meant to be to do the podcast with me. And I went, right, let's go do the podcast. And then Phil went, am I doing the podcast? I'd forgotten and hadn't.
Right.
But
when you said you were putting the curtain back on the podcast, I didn't mean specifically my levels of competence.
No, because I'm going to tell the story later on makes me look even more incompetent than you are right now. But what we've done is that the extra 2 hours that you have had to prepare for this podcast as a result has given birth to this incredible
list.
This
didn't take me 2 hours, but it took me most of 2 hours. Nick, originally, my brother, was supposed to be in the podcast, so I apologise for Nick fans, but he couldn't be here today.
Nick fans.
I'm basically talking to Mum. Hi, Mum. City of Crime by Dan Aykroyd and Tom Hanks is terrible.
No, it's not terrible. It's great.
It's terrible, it's but great. Awesome.
It's awesomely terrible.
Awesomely terrible.
Or terribly awesome.
It's awesomeable. It featured in an Empire Online feature that we did a while back called 15 Glorious, the awful 80s end credit songs.
Yeah.
Don't tell Nick that one.
I think he may have.
He probably knows.
He may be aware of it.
I always thought that Born Slippy finishes Trainspotting, but it doesn't. Kind of runs up until the credits, and then it becomes...
It's pulp, isn't it?
It becomes Closet Romantic by Damon Albarn, I believe.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So that kind of knocks out Born Slippy, I would imagine. Samuel Barber's Adagio for Strings always gets me in the feels. The end of Platoon. Mm-hmm. We talked about Mad World from Donnie
exactly
Darko.
Thematically, I mean, there's no lyrics.
Thematically.
Yeah, it's not, you know...
The music speaks, doesn't it? It speaks of... I get sort of napalm and M16s from that, don't you?
Okay. No, sure.
I don't know. It's sad anyway.
It is very.
It's mournful. It's an elegy to, you know, the doomed youth of Vietnam.
It is.
Just Like Honey, Jesus and Mary Chain from the end of Lost in Translation.
Mm-hmm.
And one of my favourites, Mighty Wings by Cheap Trick from the end of Top Gun.
Sure.
Because they're in planes, they've got wings.
Wings. I get it.
Wings.
Yeah.
Wings.
They're mighty wings.
Wings. I like also a lot of David Fincher here. There's a cracking one at the end of Social Network where he uses Baby You're a Rich Man by the Beatles.
Mm.
Again, maybe slightly on the nose, but it's sound to me because it's very hard to get the Beatles to license their tracks for movies. And a lot of people have failed. In fact, Wes Anderson wanted to finish... I believe he wanted to finish the Royal Tenenbaums with Hey Jude.
That's right.
And they wouldn't, for whatever reason, wouldn't or couldn't license the song. So he had to use something else instead. I think
they
he
did
used
a cover.
Morrison. There's a cover.
There's a cover by...
There's I'm Looking Through You.
Yeah.
There's a cover of that, I think. Again, people are going to yell at us for being wrong. I cannot emphasize this enough. No preparation went into the making of this podcast. But there's a Van Morrison track now on Royal Tenenbaums. And then there's that, of course, as well. But Baby, You're a Rich Man, the real, actual, genuine John Lennon written article is in The Social Network. And that's very, very good. And I have a soft spot. You know, you get all these MOR ballads, very much an 80s tradition. Mm. And there's one man who's been trying to revive that tradition. James Cameron does it, actually. He obviously, My Heart Will Go On for Titanic. But Matthew Faughn has been trying to revive this tradition single-handedly with one band in particular, Take That. On Stardust, Rule the World was the song that kind of announced to the world that Take That were back, and Barlow was back, and Barlow wasn't any—he wasn't taking any shit from anybody. And this is a belter of a track, and so much it worked really, really well. So much so that I think Fawn has repeated it on about 17 other movies since, with diminishing results. But I really like Rule the World.
The banger.
It is a banger. It's hard to and the lyrics pertain to the story of those characters. Those unfeirgettable characters. What are their names? What are their names, John? Help me.
Which ones?
The ones in Stardust. Claire Danes and Charlie Cox's characters.
Oh,
Dusty.
Who can forget
Dusty and Star
Features. Star-Lord.
Star-Lord
and Dusty.
Star-Lord and Dusty Springfield.
Who can forget their adventures?
Glorious relationship.
One of my favourite soundtracks is from Stanley Kubrick's Full Metal Jacket.
Yes.
And that ends with Paint It Black. I don't know if thematically that counts, because no one does any painting in the film. But let alone the kind of painting that require black paint.
Thematically black.
But it's dark.
Yes.
So, kind of.
I mean, if we're talking on the nose, what could be more on the nose than Iron Man at the end of
Iron
Man? That's true. that does feel relevant.
Yeah. That's actually quite unusual for the MCU as well to have end credit songs in that way. I mean, there have been a couple. But yeah, I think it works.
Yeah, it totally works.
In that film. Hmm. Yeah, just about. But you put me in mind of Sympathy for the Devil ending, I think it's a Guns N' Roses version actually, which ends Interview with the Vampire.
Oh yeah.
A Neil Jordan film. Yeah. And obviously The Crying Game, I believe, ends with The Crying Game. Hmm. We could go on all day.
There's so many. A couple that aren't thematically relevant but I love and I mentioned them anyway are God Moving Over the Face of the Waters by Moby
God.
At the end of Heat is probably one
amazing.
Of my all-time favourites.
Extraordinary stuff.
And Beck's cover of the Corgis' Gotta Learn Sometime from the end of Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind I also love very much. Mm. And you're just staring at me playing.
No, I am, yeah.
Because you've forgotten everything.
No, I have.
Thematically.
Right. Yeah, thematically. And
wiped your memory.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah, good one.
It is a good one.
No, not what I just said. Just that's a good track.
Oh, right, okay.
Good one, me.
No, yes. No, you're doing well, Phil.
Thanks. You made my dreams come true, Chris.
Should we move on?
Yeah.
John, any more before we move on? Because we're literally at the point now where we're just listing songs.
No, we're just saying songs. Fine. My Way, the end of Goodfellas, Sid Vicious cover.
Oh, yeah, that's yeah. Good. That's a belter. That's a belter. So I hope the Stadius 15, we've answered your question in some depth. Yeah. But again, people are probably yelling at us for missing obvious contenders. But hey ho, if you want to have your question read out in the Emperor podcast and answered by this team of babbling idiots, then send them in to Twitter at Emperor Magazine is our handle. Use the hashtag Emperor podcast. We're also on Facebook as Emperor Magazine. And you can email us as well if that's your bag. podcast@empireonline.com. Okay, time now for our first guests. The Walking Dead finishes its seventh season this Sunday or Monday in the UK. 7 of 20, according to showrunner Scott Gimple. Two men have been mainstays of the show since it began on either side of the camera are Norman Reedus, who plays Daryl. If Daryl dies, we riot. And Greg Nicotero, the special effects genius who became one of the show's chief creative forces as producer and director and bloke who makes the zombies look great. They came to London a couple of weeks ago and they spoke to the Walking Nugent. Enjoy.
We are delighted to welcome to the Empire podcast Norman Reedus and Greg Nicotero and The Walking Dead. How are you?
Jet lagged, but we're great.
The Walking Dead works us so hard that we sleep every second that we can and we just woke up.
Excellent. Well, you're looking fresh. You're looking good.
Yeah.
Oh, right. Thanks.
I kind of wanted to start off not with a question, but with just a statement. Thank you very much for Easy Streets, which has definitely not been in my mind for the last 3 months, just on loop.
Well, that's you can thank Scott Gimple for that one.
Can we talk a little bit about these sort of bottle episodes? What's it like to be separated from the rest of the group?
Oh God, it's horrible. The first half was really hard for a lot of us, because we were separated and we weren't, you know, we weren't the badasses in town for the first half. And, you know, I mean, there's a guy running around with my clothes on. He's got all my stuff.
There's a tiger.
Andy and I are crying the whole time. All the girls are being badass. And Andy and I are going, we used to be so cool on the show. What happened? But it was hard. I mean, you know, you put yourself in that, you know, that headspace, and it's just a drag. And I said to Scott, I was like, this first half, it sucks for me. Like, it just sucks. And he goes, well, it's supposed to suck. And, you know, you take these people and you bring them down, and you can bring them up higher on the other end, you know?
The end of season six and the start of this season started off so bleak. I mean, it was a really tough way to start the season. And it started to get a bit more optimistic.
Intense,
yes.
Let's use the word intense, because yeah. I think that adequately describes where the show went the first half of the season. But, you know, if you really look back at it in retrospect, we were excited about the introduction of Negan and the new direction that the show was going on. Knowing that this season gave us the kingdom and gave us the sanctuary, we really have been able to express ourselves more powerfully visually, you know, adding a tiger, you know, into the show. And Ezekiel, it's great after 7 years of making sure that the audience does not get fatigued and goes on this journey with us. It's pretty important.
Let's talk a little bit about the kingdom, because this is a sort of fascinating addition to the show. I mean, as we're speaking just after, I think, episode 11 of this season, and we last saw Daryl taking refuge at the kingdom with Ezekiel, and that's quite an odd couple, I guess. Ezekiel, this sort of Shakespearean leader.
Yeah, I don't know that Daryl trusts this guy right off the bat. You know, it's kind of this no bullshit world that we live in, and then all of a sudden there's a lot of bullshit in a tiger, and it seems very strange. You know, and then, you know, taking refuge is a nice way to say it, but they keep leaving me behind everywhere. But I don't, you know, it's very odd. This guy's speaking like he's in Macbeth or something, and he's, you know, got this whole, all these people following his lead. But I mean, you directed him, you brought him into this world. Like, you probably know more about him than me.
No, but it's a great character. It's a great world. The challenge for us was saying, okay, how do we keep this? How do we keep this tied to the Walking Dead world without as outrageous as it is? So directing that episode was like shooting a pilot. We were introducing all these new characters, this entire new world. Melissa and Lenny were the only two regulars that were in the show in that particular episode. So it was very challenging, very much like when we got to Alexandria for the first time, making sure that the show still felt like The Walking Dead, but changed personality a little bit. So with Kari and Carl and Cooper and all the new characters that we've introduced, it's been really interesting, and I think really adds a lot to the show, because we are expanding and we are growing, and these worlds all have a very specific place in terms of where the story goes.
And it's been 7 years now. It's been nearly a decade, and obviously the walkers are, I mean, some of them are looking pretty gnarly. I mean, what's the sort of challenges with you know, special effects and makeup when you have walkers who are decomposing in this way?
Well, I think what we've really made a conscious effort of doing is keeping the designs tied into storylines. you know, Scott will come up with some ideas and he'll immediately reach out. Hey, I have this idea for this art installation type zombie. Even the walkers in the Oceanside episode with Tara that were in the sand pile. We really wanted them to look different. The idea that they were buried under the sand and they were desiccated and lacking any sort of moisture. It's just good after 7 years to kind of keep,
that's how I feel
keep
right
changing
now.
That's how you feel right now.
Lacking any lacking sort of moisture.
Lacking in moisture. Did you sleep under a sand pile for the last half hour?
Yeah, I feel like it, yeah.
So it's a constant thing. Listen, you know, I mean, I'm a fan as well. You know, I love the show, and if I wasn't working on it, I would want to see something different. I would want to see what the guys can come up with, and that's something that it's important for us to keep it fresh and to come up with new interesting things. You know, the walker, the cable on the freeway chopping all the walkers in half, was my homage to Grindhouse and Robert Rodriguez.
Right.
And I thought, you know, the show, you gotta sort of remind the audience every once in a while that the world is still dead, because we've spent a lot of time with all the human drama. So every once in a while, we have to sort of reintroduce the fact that the world is a dead place. And we did it in that episode in a very spectacular fashion, because you see the walkers coming up the freeway, and then the cars take off and chop them all in half. It was a lot of it was meant to be a moment where everybody kind of cheered. And, I got a lot of great response from that. It wasn't in the script. As a matter of fact, I storyboarded in the original script. Rosita opens the sunroof and throws the tennis ball detonator out of the sunroof and blows up some of the explosives. And when we read it, I remember saying, my first instinct to Scott was, well, they're surrounded by a bunch of walkers. We've kind of seen that. Let's think of a way to sort of up it. So that gag happened. I still wanted to retain Rosita doing something badass in the other car that they were she was trapped in with Tara and Carl. So we wanted, of course, we wanted both. And they're like, well, we're not sure we can afford to shoot all of that stuff, because we had 8 days to shoot the whole episode. But it was, you know, we were really excited about that sequence, because it was fun and over the top and big and sort of rambunctious.
Yeah, it was quite an opener. And then we're starting to see zombies, walkers weaponized now. We're getting walkers with spikes. And is this a direction that the show's going to go down? Maybe sort of more zombie battles?
Well, I think even more so than that particular walker in episode 10. But the fact that Eugene comes up with this great way of pouring molten lead on the tops of their heads.
Yeah.
Because now all of a sudden, melted to the fence, but you can't kill them.
Yeah.
You can't stab them in the head, because the head is encased in melted, hardened metal. And I love that idea. I love the idea that, oh, wait a second. I mean, you could do that and preserve these zombies so that everything along the fence at the sanctuary is indestructible.
Yeah.
Unless they just rot and fall to pieces.
It's certainly possible. Guys, thank you so much for your time.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Thank you.
How was that, John?
Very nice.
Yeah.
Norman Reedus was a bit jet-lagged, but he looked fresh as a daisy, and I was very excited to meet him.
Good.
Yes.
Good. Greg Nicotero's a good guy, isn't he?
He's great.
He's a good guy.
He's great.
My best ever photobomb was in the Norman Reedus photograph at Comic-Con a few years ago. I was doing a red carpet thing with him at a Walking Dead breakfast, and with the cast of The Walking Dead, and Reedus and Andrew Lincoln were in front of me, and they took a picture, a selfie of themselves, and I got in the back of the picture, like, grinning like an idiot. And it went semi-viral in terms of, you know, how these things go on Twitter. And loads of people went, who's that in the background? Is it Alan Carr? No, it's not fucking Alan Carr.
Ouch.
I've got shorthand glasses, big teeth, and my own chat show. But no, I'm not Alan Carr. Anyway, there we go.
Photobopping.
That's a great new. You've invented a great new craze.
Photobopping from the '50s. Is that still a thing?
Photobombing.
Yeah.
I
don't seem to hear about. You don't see a lot of.
No, it's not really.
It seems to have stopped. But
bring it back.
Yeah, I still. There's something about a good photobomb.
Hmm.
Well timed.
What about Danny DeVito's foot? Is that still? What's he doing?
It's not really foot bombing, is it? You know, because the pictures were
of his foot
were built around the
right.
foot. Yeah,
everything else is bombing.
What did he call his foot? Trollfoot.
Trollfoot.
Trollfoot. Yeah. Do you remember when he came in for the podcast with Richard Griffiths a few years ago, and then they were right near the Heat magazine offices, and the ladies of Heat just took to Danny DeVito, basically adopted him as their mascot for the day, and it was an amazing shot. We didn't get this, but the Heat staff did, of Danny DeVito surrounded by the entirety of the Heat staff. This is about 57 people, something like that, and he has his shoe and sock off with his foot, troll foot, raised up in just pride of place, and everyone just beaming and loving it, despite the fact that a strange man has walked in. Try this. Try walking into someone's office, taking off your shoe and sock and raising up your foot and declaring it troll foot. Troll foot has visited your office. You'll be kicked out.
Yes.
You wouldn't have time to put your shoe and sock back on.
Yeah.
Should we talk about movie news?
Yeah.
Yeah. Seems like a natural segue.
Don't forget, you can still vote for us in the Listener's Choice Awards at the British Podcast Awards. Voting is available online.
Is there a best segue category?
Yeah.
Okay. Movie news. Well, there's only really one story this week, isn't there?
Is there?
Wreck-It Ralph's title.
I mean, yeah.
Wreck-It Ralph's title. No, that's not true. The big story, of course, Joss Whedon.
Joss Whedon.
He's manoeuvred into three roles on the DC Batgirl movie.
So there's producer, writer, and Batgirl himself.
Exactly.
He's playing the title role. A shock move. Yeah, he really can do anything, can't he? Joss Whedon is, I'm not sure, officially signed. Yeah, Friday we're reporting in talks, which naturally has been twisted to has signed, but probably by the time you listen to this, he will have crossed the... You cross the T's and you dot the I's. He'll have done that. On Batgirl.
Yeah.
For Warner Brothers / DC. So the DC Extended Universe. They're adding standalone Batman movies to this series. Like there's no tomorrow. So there's a Nightwing movie. There's a Batgirl movie. Alfred will probably get his own movie, which I'd quite like to see. Jeremy Irons running around, turning his nose up at everything around him. Go, oh, what is this? What have I done? I think it could be quite fun. And Joss Whedon is obviously an amazing writer and director. I believe he had a hand in some Marvel movies I may or may not like. I applaud this. I'm intrigued. You know, let's be honest, the DC movies so far haven't entirely hit the mark. But given the dues, they're keeping going. And they've got some really interesting talent. James Wan and Aquaman, I think, is going to be very, very interesting. And Joss Whedon on Batgirl. And Matt Reeves on the Batman. These are good, really solid directors who will bring something to these movies.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because Joss Whedon was attached to do Wonder Woman about 10 years ago.
Yeah.
And it kind of just fell apart. And there were, it wasn't really clear why it fell apart. I guess they didn't quite come to an understanding about how it would turn out. So it is sort of interesting that he's been coaxed back into the DC fold. And also that he's jumped ship from Marvel, I guess.
I don't think there's a question of choosing sides necessarily. No. It's interesting that he'll be the first person to make a movie, if this happens, make a movie for both studios. That's going to be interesting. But of course, as you say, he started out with Wonder Woman. He's a bipartisan guy. He likes Marvel and DC. He's absolutely fine with that sort of stuff. So I don't think it's a question of choosing sides. I do think, and if you listen to our Avengers Age of Ultron spoiler special, I don't think it's any secret that he had some run-ins with certainly some executives at Marvel and at Disney about that, and maybe that was more of a bruising experience for him than the Avengers was. So he may not want to immediately make another movie or be associated with Marvel right away. But it's interesting to see that he's going to go for DC, who, of course, also had Patty Jenkins, who had a bad experience at Marvel with Thor: The Dark World.
Yeah.
So maybe they're positioning themselves. And I've said this before in the podcast. Maybe the DC movies are positioning themselves a little bit more like the director-friendly studio. You can come here and your vision will be unencumbered, and we'll by and large leave you alone, and you can make your film. Whereas Marvel is a bit more like Bond and a bit more like Eon, where the producers are the star necessarily, and the directors sometimes were just people for hire.
But that's a byproduct of the fact that the Marvel Cinematic Universe has cohered in a way that DC can only really dream of at this point. Therefore, they've got more to lose by deviating in kind of weird creative directions or unusual creative directions, which may be why Whedon suffered a bit on Avengers, because his sensibility is perhaps comic in a slightly different way, naturally, than what came before him.
Yeah, although I get the impression he always wanted to make a darker film. I think he wanted to make a darker film than he made.
Maybe so. I mean, maybe he'll get that opportunity at DC, which does seem to be hewing darker than. I mean, you could argue that for all its flaws, DC might be in a better position to take its universe in a darker direction than the MCU could at this point. Maybe the fact that the MCU is so successful gives it less wiggle room than DC can probably start again a little bit, reset, and maybe Joss Whedon's part of that. Because to my mind, he and Zack Snyder don't really have much commonality as filmmakers. So if Zack Snyder's overseeing this thing as it develops...
I don't think he is.
But he's overseeing, you know, the opening kind of...
Yeah, the opening
development, which goes a long way to setting the tone of the thing.
Yeah.
You can't really... I mean, Suicide Squad probably was an outlier, but it's still, even then, it's still, you could still kind of see it fitting in. It still had a sort of a darkness to it, a heaviness. So it'd be interesting to see, because I don't, you know, Joss Whedon's quite different from anything that's gone before, but he's such a good filmmaker and such a good writer, I think.
Yeah.
I would love his writing. I think people love his writing. They love what he's done. You know, it's Buffy's anniversary, so he's back in the limelight for two reasons at the moment. And, you know, Serenity and Firefly and Doll's House, all the things that he's done previously, I think he's built this huge kind of passionate fan base with him. And maybe there is a bit of conflict amongst them about the fact that he's moved from, you know, Marvel to DC, but the more good filmmakers you have, good writers you have, the better, I think, because we're going to see these films whether
we want all these films to be good, and we want, you know, and it is interesting. I've said this in the podcast before, that Bond Marvel comparison, and obviously Bond over the last few years has moved towards a more director driven model. Sam Mendes wouldn't have come on otherwise. And I think that as you look at the way the Marvel films are developing, you know, they are going for filmmakers like Shane Black and Taika Waititi and Ryan Coogler, who have singular visions as well, and they can mesh with that producer driven model. But I also think the talent that for the most part that is being assembled on the DC movies is really interesting, and I haven't been a fan so far, for the most part, of what's been produced, but I'm really excited about a Joss Whedon background movie. I mean, but how is it going to fit in? Is it going to be a standalone? Is it going to work necessarily? Batgirl, in case you don't know, is Barbara Gordon, who's the daughter of Commissioner Gordon. We've seen her, of course, as voiced by Rosario Dawson in the Lego Batman movie. So, yeah, it's going to be very, very... interesting to see where we go with this.
James Gunn's done a great job with Guardians. I'd love to have seen a Joss Whedon Guardians of the Galaxy movie.
I think he was a bit busy at the time.
I know he was, of course, but I mean, there's going to be more, isn't there? You know, Serenity's kind of quite a similar
Serenity
proposition.
Now. But let's stay on DC, actually, and talk about the Justice League trailer, which came out last Saturday, so after the podcast went up. What did we make of it? What did we think?
It's interesting, isn't it? There's some nice moments in there. I think it does feel like they're consciously trying to... row back some of the tone that Batman vs Superman had. There are some really sort of light, quite likable, funny moments here. I mean, there's some really good exchanges between Ben Affleck's Batman and Ezra Miller's Flash. I really like the bit where the Flash asks Batman, or asks Bruce Wayne, what's your superpower? And he just says, I'm rich. You know, that's nice. That's nice. And that's the sort of humour that we haven't quite seen in the DCEU before. So it does feel like there is a bit of a, like they're trying something out new for this universe.
Yep.
But there's also a lot that seems quite familiar. There's a lot of...
It feels visually very much of a piece with Batman versus Superman.
It does.
Yeah.
I think the CGI seems about par for the course, and not all of it looks great. I mean, this is, you know, it's a trailer, so obviously there's lots of work to be done, but... There seems to be a huge amount of green screen on this movie, which, you know, I guess that's a superhero movie.
Again, par for the course for pretty much. I thought there's two big trailers actually this week we should talk about Spider-Man Homecoming as well. I wasn't blown away by either trailer, I'll be honest with you, but I think that there's certainly grounds for encouragement with both. There's going to be a slightly lighter tone, just by sheer dint of the characters are going to be interacting with each other in Justice League. Ezra Miller is fantastic and a very, very funny guy in real life. And if you can impart some of that into Barry Allen, then I think it's going to be great. It's going to fly very, very well. What's interesting about that trailer, and I'm not surprised by this in the least, is that they're not even remotely hinting at Superman, who we know is in the movie, but we don't know in which capacity. Is he going to come back as evil Superman and give the Justice League a bad guy that they can fight against? Or is that just simply repeating in a way what Batman Superman did and having one of the heroes as an adversary, and then obviously he'll get a bump in the head and realize he's okay and he'll come back? Or is he going to come back triumphant at the end to save them whenever they're up shit creek without a bat paddle? So what do we reckon?
Do you think it'll be a Fast and Furious 8 style? It's like Vin Diesel, and he's been turned against the team.
Oh,
turned against family. Oh,
family.
The family.
Yeah.
I think he's still dead.
You think he's still dead?
Yeah, I think he's dead.
You think he's dead?
Him. That's it.
That's
surely.
It. No more Superman.
Done.
Surely. Ever.
Done.
Finished.
Oh, Phil. How what? Naive.
Oh, come on.
Sweet
how
Phil.
Painfully.
You're so cynical.
Oh, Phil.
You're so cynical. Yeah.
A single tear is rolling down my cheek now for poor, naive,
such
optimistic Phil.
Such childlike innocence.
They surely wouldn't kill off their
cash cow.
Their cash cow.
No, I mean, I saw somebody say that Superman will definitely be in Justice League, and then somebody else on the internet was like, that's a spoiler. But I mean, the last movie spoiled it. Like, you saw the dust, the soil, like, rising from his grave. Like,
yeah.
I mean, of course he's not bloody dead. It's Superman.
Yeah.
Can't kill him.
It could have been a geological anomaly.
It could have been.
Or some form of earthquake.
It could have been. I'm fascinated to see how they get Superman back into it. I think to echo other people who've said this, it is clear that Jason Momoa is having the time of his life as Aquaman, aka Arthur Curry.
That's not his real name, is it?
It's his real name in the comic book.
Okay.
Is Jason Momoa's real name is Jason Momoa.
Arthur Curry.
That
sounds like something out of a Carry On movie.
Yeah.
What you have,
Arthur Curry?
Oh yeah, had Arthur Curry last night.
Yeah.
No.
And then of course there's who can forget? Cyborg. He's in that movie.
Oh yes.
Yep.
Cyborg.
Don't mention the Borg.
And then let's segue seamlessly onto the Spider-Man Homecoming trailer. Which I thought was fine, it was okay. I'm sure the movie will be entertaining, but I think it does throw up the question, can you make a radically different Spider-Man movie? And were we wrong maybe to expect a radically different Spider-Man movie from what's come before? Or are we simply going to get a Spider-Man movie done right, which you could argue we haven't had since Spider-Man 2?
Tom Holland, great, really good in Captain America.
Mm-hmm.
Enjoyed that a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Stole the show. Just going to take me a bit longer to get excited about watching another Spider-Man movie.
Yeah.
At this point.
I know what you mean.
I don't want to... I sort of like the whole...
It excites me to see
and
Spider-Man Chim-Man. And Iron Man together. It excites me to see Downey as Tony Stark, even with his dad going through divorce, blonde highlights, and he's clearly having some sort of midlife crisis. What is that about? It excites me to see even that brief Chris Evans cameo that's in the trailer where he's playing Captain America, but as a sort of training video type thing, which is clearly fun. And it'll excite me to see Spider-Man in this universe playing with these characters, but the rest of the movie did seem... The rest of the trailer does seem a little bit like, what's new?
It just it just felt slightly derivative of previous Spider-Man movies, and we've seen that movie so many times now, that sort of same villain in New York... and Spider-Man saves the day. I mean, there's the shot where the Staten Island ferry is being split apart and he uses his web to bring it back together, which seemed identical to the Tobey Maguire when he's got the
train.
The metro train,
But this time Iron Man seems to come and help, so that's new. That's a new little wrinkle.
Yep.
And it seems to be some sort of plot within the film about how Tony Stark is not entirely sure that Peter Parker is ready for this great responsibility, and maybe he takes his spider suit off him. So there, could be a dick move in Tony's part, but then Tony is not a man beyond a dick move, so we shall see.
Here's a film that I really liked a while back, Chronicle, right?
Yeah.
Chronicle. I mean, that for me, had was more interesting than the idea of, you know, a third act in which Spider-Man swings around defeating CG villains. Like, I liked the fact that he was using his powers, learning to use... They were learning to use the powers in weird ways and trying to control them and see where that took them. I hope this film has a lot of that stuff in it.
Yeah.
And but we'll see. I mean, you know, who knows?
We shall see. You know, I think there's a lot of grounds for optimism from both Justice League and Spider-Man Homecoming. And we shall see. The other trailer I want to talk about is that came out, or two trailers actually I want to talk about that came out this week that really excited me. One is It. Stephen King's It, the adaptation of that, which looks really, really great. Looks like they've nailed the tone. They're adapting, in this case, Andy Muschietti, the director, is directing, adapting the first part of King's novel. So it's focusing on the group of kids who encounter It, which is this millennia-old alien in a town called Derry in Maine, which can take the form of your greatest fear. And for the most part, that is a horrible, evil clown called Pennywise. And the trailer just seems really bleak and scary. And Bill Skarsgård seems to have nailed, although we haven't heard him speak yet, he seems to have nailed Pennywise. Looks really interesting. And the other one is A Ghost Story, which is the... Did anyone see the trailer for this?
Yeah, I did.
The new film from David Lowery, which reunites Rooney Mara and Casey Affleck. And it's fantastic. This is a wonderful concept. The concept is, if you haven't seen the trailer, go to check it out immediately. This film looks incredible and a shot at the top of my most anticipated list. And it is about a couple, Rooney Mara and Casey Affleck, who, of course, previously starred for Lowery in Ain't and Body Saints. Affleck is killed and comes back as a ghost, but it's not a horror film. It seems to be it's a metaphorical horror film, and he comes back as a ghost with a literal white sheet over his head, and he haunts Mara's house, the house that they used to live in, as she gets on with her life and as she begins to forget about him and move on and raise a family. And it seems to move in far into the future as well, and he's just hanging around, just looking at the echoes of the past. This could be a movie that might break. If I had a heart, it would break it. But yeah, it looks very, very interesting.
It's something of a pisser for Jeremy Dyson and Andy Nyman's Ghost Stories, I would imagine. Looking at
yes,
needing to change the title potentially. I don't know.
I don't think they will, because obviously that's
based on
it's tied into the play that
the
thousands
play.
Upon thousands of people
yeah,
have seen.
Okay, I guess not.
And it's a very, very different thing. Ghost Stories is going to set out to scare the shit out of you.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
A ghost story is yeah. not. So yeah.
Well, don't go see them both. They both sound great.
Yeah, they both sound fantastic. Any other bits of
media
news?
Just I guess the big kind of industry news this week was the CinemaCon event in Vegas, in which all of the big studios go and woo the exhibitors and the big theatre chains in America with their latest offerings. So we saw more footage from Wonder Woman. We found out that, as before mentioned, Wreck-It Ralph, sequel is called Wreck-It Ralph Breaks the Internet.
I think it's just Ralph.
Ralph Breaks the Internet.
Yeah.
Sorry, my bad.
As pertaining to Kim Kardashian, I believe that is a reference to Kim Kardashian.
Yeah.
Breaks
yeah.
the Internet.
Is,
yeah.
that, okay.
Is that a Disney movie referencing a nude photograph?
I guess so, yes.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
Interesting. Yep. Intriguing.
Walt's frozen head is now spinning rapidly.
Yeah. And Sony showed off their Blade Runner 2049 footage, got Ryan Gosling and Harrison Ford down, not by plane, and Tom Rothman put it down to Netflix. Netflix, my ass, when he showed off this massive, big widescreen offering that they have, returning to Ridley Scott's world. And that was sort of the undercurrent of the week, I think. There was a lot of like what happens next in terms of windows, theatrical windows. How do the big movie studios kind of hit back against the streaming model that's developing?
Yeah.
It's far too dry to get into in great detail in this podcast.
No, but there was some interesting stuff.
Some interesting stuff. It's worth having a look at some of the articles that came out of it.
About how they feel that there is a feeling growing within the industry that studios or one studio might break away from the pack and do away with the window between cinematic release and DVD, Blu-ray, home entertainment release, which could have a huge effect. And then obviously other studios might follow suit if that is successful. So the idea would be that, you know, you wouldn't necessarily need to go see Episode 8 in a multiplex with 200 strangers. You spend 50 quid. I think we talked about this before. This is not a new idea. You spend 50 quid to watch it at home on opening day on your TV with your mates around.
Yeah.
And how can cinema survive that? That's going to be interesting to see if that happens.
It sounds to me like they're throwing darts at an invisible... They don't know where the dartboard is yet. I mean, we have our generation maybe, or the generation that's having kids or about to have kids, suddenly gets into the bracket where it's too expensive to go to the cinema because of babysittings, etc. The millennial generation is still going to the movies. Last year was a very big movie for US domestic box office. The question is, the next generation after that, Gen Z, you know, using their phones a lot, not sitting and consuming a lot of long-form content, potentially. Mm. Are they going to go to the cinema when they get into their 20s and 30s? They don't know the answer to that yet. Mm. Are you going to spend £30-40 paying to watch Spider-Man Homecoming on the day it's out on your telly? I'm not. I mean, I just think they don't know the answer to that. So, and they've also got to keep the cinema chain suite as well, which is another challenge. And do they pay them a cut of that? Or
they may feel they don't need the cinema chains ultimately. If this is a big success, and they can even have, you know, I read one report where they were going, well, we realise that if you pay 50 quid, say, that's okay, let's use Spider-Man Homecoming as an example. You pay £50 for Spider-Man Homecoming, what's to stop you cramming 50 friends into your front room? And even you could even sell tickets on the sly for that. It would just, so what they're talking about is a company that could develop a software.
What you're talking about is illegal.
Well, what they could, well, of course it's illegal, but you could. And you have a camera as part of the software that's attached to, you know, we all have cameras in our front rooms pretty much, whether you have Xbox, whatever it is. And they would scan the room to see, oh, you're watching this with 4 people, all right, so the price has gone up. Or you're watching this with 10 people, all right, you have to pay this much, which obviously has all sorts of privacy issues attached to it as well. But it's going to be an interesting time. I do feel that a reckoning is coming, a change is coming, that there are cinema chains that really put an emphasis on the pleasure of going to the cinema.
Yeah.
And then there are others that don't, that just see us as consumers and customers to be, you know, to be shuffled in and shuffled out again.
Netflix is saying that the cinema hasn't really changed, but the popcorn's got tastier. That's it. But actually, I think, you know,
I think there are
cinema chains
great
are working
chains.
Really hard to make the experience more pleasurable and fun. And I also think what you might see is like movies doubling down. You know, Christopher Nolan, people like that, making bigger films, saying "fuck it, we're just going to go even larger and make more of a point of difference between watching Netflix and watching films on the big screen." And also, like Christopher McQuarrie said on the live podcast, you know, that maybe they'll let go of this audience chasing this younger demographic and just make filmmaker driven content, which I think will pull people into the cinemas naturally.
Mm. I think part of it might also be that, you know, cinemas have to maybe be a little bit bolder in terms of keeping films in the cinema for a little longer. If a film doesn't perform well now in this opening weekend, it is jettisoned like that. And, you know, I know it's economically difficult to put some faith into a movie going, okay, it hasn't hit in week one, it hasn't hit in week two, but week three, I'm telling you guys, it's going to be gangbusters. But maybe that's something that has to happen as well down the line. But, of course, one thing Netflix has that conventional cinema does not have at the moment is Adam Sandler. And they're going to have more and more Adam Sandler. 4 more Adam Sandler Netflix films are on the way because you demanded it.
You're looking at John.
I am looking at John. I saw him refreshing.
My letter writing campaign finally paid off.
Yeah.
These people write letters to Netflix. Got another story. Barry Jenkins, of course, Oscar-winning Moonlight director.
Yep.
Has signed up with Amazon for a miniseries.
For a subscription to Amazon Prime.
For a subscription, yeah. For
well
a subscription.
Done him.
He gets a discount. The Underground Railroad, which is set in pre-Civil War, antebellum South of America, about the actual Underground Railroad that smuggled slaves north across the border, into the north.
That's cool.
Yeah,
that's
right. It's a great story.
It's not literally underground, though, right?
Apparently it kind of was. Oh, it wasn't just metaphorically underground, although it kind of was. But it actually had tunnels and you know, tracks. And it's about a character, a slave called Cora, who kills a young white boy who tries to capture her as she's making her escape, and then has to flee whilst being hunted. So that's Barry Jenkins next, which will be more of a television type thing.
good on you, Baz Ajay. And then we should probably finish by just mentioning that Robert Rodriguez is the frontrunner to direct the Escape from New York remake. In fact, he's not the frontrunner. John Carpenter basically said on Twitter that he's doing it. And what do we make of that?
I mean, I'm not sure the world needs an Escape from New York remake, but there are worse people to direct it than someone like Robert Rodriguez, who I guess gets the, you know, sensibility of John Carpenter, that sort of B-movie aesthetic. So perhaps it's a good thing. I mean,
no, I feel that, you know, I've said, again, I don't want to keep repeating myself, but I think that there's an amazing talent in Robert Rodriguez, and I think that that talent has atrophied over the years, and his involvement with Battle Angel Alita and James Cameron and now this maybe means he, you know, someone's lit a fire under his ass, and you know, maybe we'll get the old Rodriguez back, so that'd be a good thing.
Maybe he's in a comfort zone.
Well, I hope he's not. I hope he's going to get out of it. But there you go, that's all the movie news. It is time now for our second guest this week. Absolute legend, the man who is Apollo Creed, who is Dylan from Predator, you son of a bitch. He is Action Jackson. He is, of course, Carl Weathers. He's now starring in the Law & Order spin-off Chicago Justice. You know I'm excited about it. And it started here this week on the Universal Channel. He came into this very pod booth yesterday to talk to me, and he was absolutely immense. I even ended up pitching a movie to him. Long story, but you'll hear it soon. Enjoy. We're delighted to be joined on the Empire Podcast by the great Carl Weathers. How are you, sir?
Oh, wow, the great Carl Weathers.
The great Carl Weathers.
Thank you, Chris.
You have earned it.
Ah, you know, I generally refer to others as the great, but to be sitting here and to be in this beautiful... By the way, today is absolutely gorgeous outside for all of those people in Radioland. I mean, it is a beautiful day in London, so I'm so happy I brought the weather to you all.
Yes, in your suitcase, in your carry-on luggage.
All of that, I had it, and when I opened it, bang, sunshine came out. Southern California sunshine came out.
Weather's brought the weather.
Yeah, weather's brought, thank you, very good. That's why you get paid the big bucks.
I think someone here gets paid big bucks, and it's not me.
Well, okay, we'll find them eventually.
We'll get to them.
Anyway. I thank you for the greeting. It's nice to be here.
Oh, fantastic.
It's absolutely fantastic.
It's a pleasure to have you. And you're here because of Chicago Justice,
yes,
which I'm very excited about because I am a massive Law & Order fan.
Oh, well.
And this is connected. This is not a spin-off necessarily.
It's an incarnation of. If you're a Law & Order fan, and hopefully if you're not, you'll become a fan of Chicago Justice because we deliver, hopefully on a week-to-week basis, in ways that people cannot imagine they're going to be entertained.
So you're playing basically an attorney general, is that correct?
I am playing the state's attorney.
State's attorney,
yeah,
yes.
You know, an attorney general type.
And okay.
In Chicago, the state's attorney is an elected official. Mm-hmm. And so Mark Jeffries, the character, is a bit of a politician, you might say. Mm-hmm. Politicians, as we all know, like to keep their jobs. And so they do a lot of promising of things that sometimes they don't deliver.
Okay.
In the case of Mark Jeffries, of course, he delivers,
of course,
man. He's, you know, he's an ethical guy.
You could not deliver.
Absolutely.
It's beyond you.
It is beyond the great to not deliver. But, you know, it's a show that obviously is a Dick Wolf show, and that right there means that there's going to be a particular type of quality about the show. And it does in its own way resemble, I suppose, Law & Order. So it's a much more contemporary version, if you would. It's a hipper version, in my opinion, because I'm so hip, you know. But I'm also a little out of my mind here, it seems.
Jet lag's a horrible thing.
Well, you know, I'm kind of over that by now.
Yeah.
It's not that. It's just that being in London is such a joy. I've been here so many times, and I get here, and I kind of get giddy. I don't know why. There's something in the water, maybe. Huh?
Okay.
I don't know. It's the London air. I'm not sure. It's the beautiful women on the street. It's it's the clothing that people are wearing. Everybody's so cool in London. They look so hip.
And then you meet me.
Oh, well.
And suddenly
Chris, you know, it just brings me back to earth. Meeting you just brings me back to earth.
What are your London haunts, Carl? Where do you go when you're here?
Well, I'm not a haunting kind of guy. I never have been.
Okay.
But I do say this. Every time I come in, I have to go stroll Savile Row.
Okay.
I have to go and look at what sartorial splendor exists on Savile Row. And see what I can afford because, man, those guys, I remember back in the day when I came here, the first time I ever went to Savile Row was, 100 years ago, maybe. And I thought it was as expensive then. It's gotten ridiculously expensive now.
They don't even let me walk on Savile Row.
Well, they let me walk, but they kick me out of stores very quickly when I when I look at things and want to say, you know, want to ask, what's the price? They, get out of here.
That's the thing. If you ask, well, then you can't
afford it.
Yeah,
exactly. And that's, you know, that's a good thing to learn in life, right? Don't ask.
Surely Chicago Justice has a pretty decent clothing budget, I imagine.
Well, they've got a clothing budget, yeah. But, you know, they don't help me out at all. I have to wear the clothes on the show and then give them back.
Oh, man, that sucks.
Yeah, I know it sucks. That's how the great Carl Weathers doesn't roll too well, you know?
I just have this vision of Dick Wolf giving you a black Amex and just saying,
really?
Hey, Carl,
really?
Have an
Is
afternoon.
That the vision of him you have?
That's a vision.
I sure wish he'd show me that vision. You know, I'm really just happy to be on the show, man. It's such a joy. And, you know, we're very fortunate too, because we have really great guest actors who come on the show, and many of them have been around, and some of them were back from the old Law and Order days. You know,
oh, fantastic!
So they've worked on Dick Wolf shows and a lot of quality shows in the States, and then we have great writers, as I said, who deliver great stories. But we also have a really wonderful group of directors who've come on the show and done such stellar work. So it makes our job as easy as one might have it in television, because it's a grind, you know, the hours. But we're very, very pleased. And so far, knock on wood, in the U.S., for those of you who don't have radios with screens and can see us, I'm literally knocking on my head when I say knock on wood.
In a very sharp suit, I may say.
Well, you know, something's got to work here. You know, we have really good directors, and they really deliver really wonderful shows, and so far in the U.S. the audiences have really embraced them. We're getting really a good viewership, and people like the show. So,
fantastic.
You know, we're not crying yet. We're not, you know, we want to do better work. We want to deliver stellar work. We want to deliver award quality work. But it's nice to come out of the shoot and have people like the show.
Oh, fantastic. And you shoot in Chicago. This is not one of the cases where
Vancouver
for Chicago.
No, exactly. You know how it goes. Vancouver for London. I'm sorry, it doesn't work, you know. No, we shoot in Chicago, as do the other Chicago shows. Mm-hmm. And so the city, you know, I don't know how many people in the audience who are listening right now have ever been to Chicago, but it is one of, maybe second to London, but it is one of the most beautiful cities in the world. Mm-hmm. You know the old line, every great city has a river running through it? Chicago has actually three. They're tributaries of the, you know, the main, but
yes.
It's a beautiful city with a magnificent skyline. Downtown is just, it's a wonder. I mean, if you have a chance to go, you've never been to Chicago, you should visit. It's a beautiful place.
So did this mean relocation for you?
It means a relocation while I'm working, but no, I head back to warm climes in Southern California. And currently, I'm sort of toying with the idea of moving. I don't know where to, you know?
Okay.
And London is such a beautiful city. Now that, to get not too political, but now that you're leaving the EU, I don't know that they'll allow me to come to London and be here for a while.
You're welcome here. We'll always offer you sanctuary.
Thank you. a sanctuary city. London is my kind of town. London is.
But look around you, Carl. Look at this gray, depressing booth. Would you really want to be here?
You know something? This kind of reminds me of my bedroom. Now, what does that tell you about me? My gray, depressing bedroom.
You have a recording studio in your bedroom.
Not quite. Not quite. But I do listen to myself. I talk to myself and listen to myself a lot. So there you are.
Can I just journey back into your past a little bit?
Yeah.
Because here at Empire, we're mad about movies and mad about some movies in particular. One of them is Predator, which is a film I absolutely adore. And there's a couple of things I wanted to ask you about that movie in particular. The shoot itself, because you guys are actually in the jungle.
We were.
Which is
It wasn't
crazy.
Vancouver doubling for
the
jungle.
Vancouver. It wasn't a green screen.
No, it wasn't. It was the real deal.
A couple of fronds on a green screen.
Yeah, exactly.
The real deal. Mm. And what was that experience like for you? Because it must have been insane at times.
It was insane at times, but in a good way.
Yeah.
You know, when you're a young actor and you get a chance to do things like that, you know, like Predator, and you get a chance, let's face it, to run around the jungle with a bunch of guys and not have to really worry about makeup, not have to worry about sweat, not have to worry about being stinky. Yeah. I mean, come on, smoking cigars, you know, drinking good booze. It was a fun time, and we had really a wonderful director in John McTiernan. And, you know, what added to that experience was, and not a lot of people talk about these things, but what added to it was, first of all, being in the jungle on location. We were in Mexico, which is not a bad location. And we were in Puerto Vallarta, which is really not a bad location, okay? In, you know, by day in the jungle, by night in the jungla, which was the disco at the time, okay? La jungla.
Okay.
And there really was a disco named La jungla. Amazing. Which was interesting. We had a crew that it consisted of Americans, mm-hmm. Mexicans, and Australians, a huge crew. And so those three diverse cultures, diverse citizens from around the world, mm-hmm. just made the experience that much more fun. Because, you know, you get a chance to interact with people that you probably wouldn't on a day-to-day basis. And there we are two and a half months,
yeah.
You know, eating together, sweating together, laughing together, you know. It was just wonderful, absolutely wonderful. And our producer, the great Joel Silver,
yes.
Who's, you know, for those of you who really love movies would know everything from... my God.
Lethal Weapon,
Matrix, Beverly Hills Cop, yeah. Jumpin' Jack Flash, the great Action Jackson. A Predator.
Absolutely.
You said Matrix. I mean, you know, some great, great movies.
Yeah.
Was our producer. And it was just an amazing time to make movies. You know, an amazing time.
There's some interesting stories I've heard about Predator. Possibly apocryphal. Maybe you can help clear them up.
Yeah.
One is that obviously... six tough guys and Shane Black.
No, six tough guys and Arnold Schwarzenegger, okay?
And there was a sense of competitiveness, shall we say, on set. And you would tell your castmates that your muscles were natural. You didn't have to work out, but you would get up in the morning.
I didn't just tell them that. That was absolutely true.
Well, that's
my
not
muscles
what I've heard.
Were natural.
I've heard that you got up in the morning, worked out, and then didn't tell
them
about that.
They were naturally pumped up. Absolutely. I'd go into the gym and Arnold took a gym everywhere.
Yeah.
Okay. That's why he was paid the big bucks. Okay. He could move his gym. And I discovered that he had a gym in the hotel in which we were staying. And of course, once I discovered that, I insinuated myself on one particular day. And when I realized that you could easily get to the key, mm-hmm. I started getting up really early, find the key, go in and work out.
Uh-huh.
Well, you know, the one thing about training is that you train hard, you start to look like you're training hard. These guys weren't dummies. They knew that, wait a minute. So now they start to get up earlier. Arnold.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
After Arnold, everybody else discovers there's a gym there, and you got Jesse, and you got Bill Duke, and you got all the entire group.
Yeah.
Everybody's trying to one-up each other by going in. So eventually, you know, I mean, call time might be 7 or 8 o'clock in the morning, getting up at 4 and 4:30 to go work out, because you can't have these guys look better than you, you know? I had to be pumped. My guns had to be right for the man shake, because I can't have Arnold Schwarzenegger one-upping me. It's just no way.
Let's clear something up once and for all. Could you really have won that arm wrestling contest?
What do you mean, could I have? It was scripted that I lost. I'd beat him in rehearsals 5 or 6 times. Come on. You know?
Midair, that's tough.
That, well.
That's a tough one.
He's a girly man. What can I say? He's a girly man.
And I just want to ask as well about Sonny Landham. What are your memories of working with him?
Oh, wow. Sonny. Sonny was a lot of fun.
Mm.
You know, the story is actually a true story.
Mm.
Sonny was really a wild man, you know. And if the rest of us were rambunctious, he was like out of his mind wild man. So the company, Joel Silver, a producer, hired a bodyguard.
Yes.
That was with Sonny. And the reason the bodyguard was hired was not to keep people away from Sonny, but to keep Sonny away from people. That's how wild he was. So it was an interesting group of personalities, you know. Shane Black, of course, the great writer of Lethal Weapon and so many other great movies, and Last Boy Scout, to name a couple, is now currently, he's written this new incarnation of Predator, and
yes,
they're already shooting in the remake of that, and I'm sure it's going to be spectacular if Shane's behind the scenes, you know, working the strings on this. But he was, you know, I think it might have been the first movie he ever acted in, and he was a bit odd. Shane's an odd guy, though, anyway. He's a writer. He's cloaked away in some room somewhere for hours on end. And then a whole host of guys. I mean, my God, Bill Duke.
Yeah,
Bill Duke. What a great human being.
And he became a director as well.
Yeah, he's a wonderful director, in fact. But what a crazy, crazy guy. I mean, look, this is Bill Duke, whom I love, by the way. But remember now, we're in Puerto Vallarta. It's hotter than hell.
Yeah,
it's humid. It's everything that you could think when you go on holiday. What do you wear? You wear shorts, t-shirt, flip-flops. When we're not working, Bill Duke is in tailored suit and tie. I'm not lying, man. I'm not lying. We went out for dinner a couple times, and Bill Duke looked like he was going to visit the Queen at Buckingham Palace. I mean, he did. He is just, you know, sartorial splendor is Bill Duke, you know? Amazing. And then Jesse Ventura. I'm not speaking out of school here, but these were back in the wrestling days. So here we are again in Puerto Vallarta. What is Jesse Ventura dressed in? Spandex tights, leopard skin tights. I'm not lying. A muscle shirt, a boa.
Uh-huh.
You know those feathery boas that people wear?
Wow.
And a beret. And these glasses with sparkles on them, sunglasses with sparkles on them, and cowboy boots. This was just that picture, right?
That's so weird. That's my Friday outfit. If you were here tomorrow.
That's it, huh?
That's what I have.
Well, you and Jesse could definitely have hung back in the day, let me tell you, man. You know, and then the only sane person, I say, in the group was yours truly. I mean, the rest of them were all bent, just really bent. They were.
Extraordinary. I have to talk about Apollo Creed as well. Just an amazing, amazing character.
Yeah.
Looking back on those films, what does that character mean for you? And
wow. Well, man, 40 years later, when people still embrace a character and embrace a movie, they've obviously embraced the franchise. You know, what is there? What can you say except how lucky am I that I was in the right place at the right time, genetically endowed with, you know, the ability to pull off this character physically. Mm. You know, had enough acting chops to be able to try to add some nuance to something that could have been a caricature.
Absolutely.
You know, you know, what do you say, man? I was just very fortunate. I'd been an athlete and had that ability, and was lucky enough that that role at that time was not given to, you know, the kind of people they wanted, because they didn't want me. They wanted a star.
Yeah.
They wanted an athlete who was well known. They wanted a boxer who could act. And as it turned out, none of that worked out. And there I happened to be, a guy who in his 20s was just lucky enough. Now I'm really aging myself, in my early 20s, that is, who was there and who was able to pull it off and who had the good fortune to work with really good actors. Of course, we all remember a guy named Sylvester Stallone.
Rings a bell.
And Talia Shire and Burt Young and the great Burgess Meredith. Got a chance to work with them, and we had a wonderful director in John Avildsen, who directed some spectacular low-budget movies. A tremendous director who just had the ability to make a low-budget movie look like it costs so much more. And to be able to direct an actor as well. And a lot of directors can't do that, you know? They know how to put the camera in a particular place. And and do all the technical stuff, but they're not necessarily good acting directors. And John just had that capability to do both. And also inspired a lot of trust, you know, because as a young actor, if you're left to your own devices, God only knows what you'll turn out. I mean, it's true, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
But, you know, I was at the time, I was a student of acting. Of course, I majored in theater.
Absolutely, yeah.
And I'd done some movies at that point and a lot of television at that point, episodic television as guest starring on a lot of shows that were very big during the day, you know, during that time. But to step into a movie and have no idea that it's going to be as big as it is, I thought it was going to be successful. I really did, you know. Mm. And out of the mouths of babes, I told someone I thought it was going to be as big as Jaws. Now, that shows you how ignorant I really was, because Jaws was, man, it was huge.
You weren't far off.
Well,
you weren't far off.
Here's an anecdote for you, though. I was, after we finished Rocky, I was doing an episode of a show called Streets of San Francisco.
Oh.
Because Rocky hadn't come out yet, right?
Gotcha.
Yeah, and I was one of the repertory players on all of Quinn Martin's shows back then. And he did Streets of San Francisco and Barnaby Jones and Cannon and a few other shows. And I did all of those shows. And back then, you could be a good guy in the beginning of the season, and by the end of the season, you're a bad guy. Or reverse it. You're a cop and you're a criminal in the same year, you know? But I was doing an episode of Streets in and we were shooting, of course, in San Francisco. And I was sitting out between takes on the pier getting makeup touch-ups. And a young guy comes walking down the pier, and he's working on the same show. And a young, attractive guy, handsome guy, blonde, and he walks up to me, and he recognizes me, and he tells me, "Oh, wow, that movie Rocky you did, really, really, I saw a screening of it. It's really great. It's going to be huge, you know." And I said, "Yeah, we think it's going to be." And I'm somewhat modest, but I'm telling you, I think it's going to be as big as Jaws. And he says to me, "Well, I just finished a little movie, and I think it's going to be as big as Rocky." And I said, "What was that?" And he said, "It's Star Wars, called Star Wars." And it was Mark Hamill. So out of the mouths of babes, you never know, man. You never know. But, you know, when you do something and you think, just there, and you think it's going to be really good.
Yeah.
Well.
You know, amazing.
40 years later, here we are.
40 years later, and of course, Creed came out, and I love that film. I thought it was amazing.
Did really well.
Yeah.
And I mean, to have so many actors who come that much longer after you and sort of pick up the mantle, and a director who writes a script and creates a world there that, again, is just as great as, you know, the original. And to have Sly do some of the best work he's ever done.
Absolutely.
I mean, ever done. You know, I really thought he should have won the Academy Award for Best Supporting Actor.
Likewise. Was
that good, because the nuance in that role, that character, and the pathos, and I mean, he really brought tears to my eyes with that character, you know? Mm. And I know the guy, so that's hard to do, bring tears to my eyes.
Absolutely.
But yeah.
Really, I think he brought tears to a lot of people's eyes when Apollo died in Rocky IV.
I've heard that many
times. Traumatic experience for me.
I've heard it many, many times. I had someone come up to me in an airport many, many years ago, and this has happened many times. It's been repeated. But a guy came up to me with his family, and a beautiful family. You know, they kind of looked like they could have walked out of one of those magazines as, you know, one of those typical families that you see. And he had a couple kids and his wife. And he walked up to me and stopped me in the airport and said, "You know, I want to tell you, I cried and my family cried when you died." And I found that compliment to be one that stuck with me all this time. Because if you can deliver something that really moves people to that extent.
Mm.
And when you think about it, the Apollo Creed character in the very beginning was, for many, a villain.
Yeah,
he was a bad guy. And to make this arc, to complete this arc, and to get to the place where, my God, you were devastated when that character goes, you know, I feel pretty good about the work that I do as a result of that, because that's what we want to do. We want to, you know, touch you, man. And it was fantastic to, you know, over the years, hear that from people.
And that was Mark Hamill in the airport as well, was it?
No, that was Very good, very good, Chris. No, that wasn't Mark.
And the last thing, Carl, is you said a few minutes ago that the running around and jumping days are behind you.
Yeah.
But we at Empire, we've never made a movie, but we a few years ago, as a thing, we went to a producer and pitched some fake movies.
Oh, boy.
All right. Okay, now I just want to tell you about this really quickly. One of the movies we pitched was called Unlandable 2, Upgrade, Holding Pattern, with Carl Weathers. That's the title. This is on the internet. This is a true thing. I want to pitch this movie to you and see if you're interested in it.
Okay.
So the movie is...
Folks, wait a minute. Before you go on, Chris.
Yep.
Wait.
No, okay, yeah.
Do you know how many times an actor walks into a place and somebody wants to pitch him a movie?
How many times has the actor been pitched a movie where his name is in the title of the
never,
movie?
Never. But I'm just saying,
almost
you know,
never.
This is brilliant.
Unless
go.
You're John Malkovich.
Go. Well, that's true. Being John Malkovich, yeah. Well, I should have worked in that movie.
You should have been Carl Weathers.
I should have been being in John Malkovich. I should have been the guy who was being John Malkovich.
You should have been
perfect.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
We're on a plane.
Yes.
Okay. A magician, a wizard, an evil wizard, casts a terrible spell on the passengers. Everyone in economy is turned into vampires. Everyone in premium economy...
I don't fly economy. I'm sorry.
We'll get to the good part.
Okay.
Everyone in premium economy is turned into werewolves, and everyone in business class is turned into zombies.
I won't fly in business class now either,
I
know they turn into zombies.
You are the pilot.
I am the pilot.
The heroic pilot who is untouched by the spell, and you must team up with someone who was upgraded... from economy to business class and has become a zombie vampire. Carl, are you in?
Wow.
We don't have a script or anything, or we can't pay you, but are you in?
Okay, I'll tell you what. I'll be in if I can have Halle Berry as the person who has moved up from economy
to business class.
To business class. Okay. I just want to be next to Halle Berry. I'm sorry, okay?
She will be in makeup as a zombie.
Oh, let me tell you, man. If you can pull Halle Berry into this mix, I'm in. It's done. Let's go.
All right, next time you're in London, we'll have the script ready. Halle will be on board.
I love it.
It's all good.
Let's go, Chris. Let's go.
Carl Weathers, it's been a pleasure. Thank you
so
much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Carl Weathers, sir, I will always regret not ending that interview. We didn't have time to talk about Arrested Development, but as we were talking about pitching that movie, Unlandable 2, Upgrade, Holding Pattern with Carl Weathers, then I didn't end on the Arrested Development line. You know, Carl, you, me, let's do it. You know, we got ourselves a stew going, baby. I should have said that.
Gotta let it go. It didn't happen.
There you go. Anyway, so I said earlier on I was going to tell you a story that made me look even more incompetent than you. Here it is. So yesterday morning I got a bus to work. I got off the bus and I looked at another bus in the bus station, and on the bus was an advertisement for Chicago Justice. I went, oh, Chicago Justice, that looks good. Oh, who's in it? Oh, these faces on the poster. I know, you know that guy, I vaguely recognize that guy. And that one looks like Carl Weathers. Carl Weathers! Shit! Carl Weathers is coming in at 11 and I forgot about it. So I raced in a panic and somehow managed to get through the interview. So that was...
How do you forget you're meeting Carl Weathers?
So basically, Hollywood, if you are doing an interview with us on the Empire podcast, you need to advertise somewhere near Chris's home for him to remember.
I was focused. I had three things yesterday. I had an interview with Jeffrey Rush for the podcast, which you'll hear later on, and Q&A with John Collins last night. I was focused on that, and the Carl Weathers thing I thought was April 7th. I thought, you know, James had said, oh, Carl Weathers is coming in, do you want to do it? And I went, yeah, sure, of course, Carl Weathers, he's a legend. And then it's actually today, it's the 30th, but I'd forgotten about that. And so, yeah, but there you go, we got there in the end. Okay, enough of our incompetence. It is time for the week's reviews. Let's start with Ben Wheatley's latest, Free Fire. It's been all of 4 weeks since he had a movie out. He's back. John Nugent, tell us about this movie.
Yes, Free Fire. I mean, the clue is in the title. It is Free Fire for 90 minutes. It is essentially a 90-minute shootout. There's a little bit of setup at the start, and there's a little bit of set down at the end. I'm not sure that's a phrase or word, but the bulk of this movie is a bunch of people shooting at each other in a warehouse. It's a single location. It's shot in Brighton, although it was set in Boston in the 1970s. It's basically an arms deal brokered between various factions. There's some Irishmen, there's Americans, there's a South African played with fantastic zeal and recklessness by Charlton Copley. And it all kind of goes wrong, and then they start shooting each other, and that's it. That is it. That is the plot. There is very little more to it than that. It's really interesting to see after something like High Rise, which Ben Wheatley's last movie, which was narratively, you know, incredibly complex and confusing and all over the place, that there is this such sort of economy of storytelling, as Helen puts in her Empire review very correctly, that it's so spare and it's so just straight to the point. I mean, they don't waste any time in establishing these characters and setting up the premise that, you know, these are just a few sort of livewire criminals who just can't help themselves. And what's brilliant as well is that it's all kind of an enormous misunderstanding.
Yes.
I mean, it's a farce.
It's a very funny film.
It's a total farce. It's incredibly funny, and it's a comedy of errors. I mean, the whole way through, I was thinking, they could have just sorted all this out if they just, like, had a chat. Like, it's based on nothing. Like, the conflict is so absurd. And so it leads to some very funny sort of encounters between the characters. I mean, Brie Larson and Armie Hammer play this sort of the most vaguely competent characters of all, but they're all just idiots.
Yeah, pretty much. Even Armie Hammer, whose Ord is unspeakably cool.
Mm.
Just a cool dude. And he's the most together. You get the sense that if he wanted to, he could probably take them all out. But he's a bit of an idiot, but he's a bit of a dope addict, and so he starts smoking a joint during the shootout and begins to lose it a little bit. And and Charlotte Copley is just hilarious in this film as Fern, who is this extravagant, wild, over the top South African gunrunner. I thought this was fantastic. This, for me, may actually be Ben Wheatley's best film. Certainly his most commercial, certainly his most accessible. It's a crowd pleaser in a way that I think A Field in England isn't, for example. it's just great. Really funny, really darkly comedic. All the characters are wild and have a chance to make an impact. And I think it's just fantastic. And it looks great as well. Set in the 1970s. Everyone is dressed in really cool duds. You know, Michael Smiley's dressed in, for some reason, in some sort of... It feels to me like he's dressed in a suit. I can't remember. He's got a bit more sartorial elegance, and Armie Hammer's rocking a polo neck, and Brie Larson's got these incredible glasses that are massive Elton John-style specs. Really good stuff.
I enjoyed it probably not as much as you guys.
Get out. Get out. No, come back, come back, come back, come back.
Okay, I'm back. But I would agree with virtually everything you said. I just felt it felt a bit baggy. I felt like, you know, I got the joke. It was funny. The dialogue wasn't quite sort of on the Reservoir Dogs-y quotability snappy scale for me. But there just wasn't quite enough going on when you got to about 50 minutes. I was like, it's just kind of continuing. The shootout's kind of continuing, and they're all terrible shots, and I kind of get that. but you know, what next sort of thing? And I would say that Ben Wheatley does a great job of keeping it visually interesting. New camera moves, camera angles, finding the geography of the space, brilliantly plotted. I know he kind of modelled it out with Minecraft the year before. So, and you get a real sense of the environment that this thing is happening in. And yeah, I think it's funny, but I mean, Ben Wheatley's best film, no, I probably would have said that compared to a Kill List or a Sightseers, it's not really on the same level for me. But I get why people like it. Just felt that it probably overstayed its welcome a little from my point of view.
Are you saying stupid people like me like it more than the other ones, which made my brain hurt?
Maybe.
Is that what you're saying?
The subtext.
Is that what he's saying, John? I can't understand what he's saying.
I don't know. There's a lot of big words
I'm
in that sentence.
I'm not saying any such thing.
My brain hurts.
Saying any such thing.
Like the film.
Don't get me wrong. Sightseers is not like, it's not that it's complicated. It's just that there's an arc that kind of carries through these two characters.
It wasn't an arc. It was a boat.
What boat?
It was a boat.
It was like a lawnmower, wasn't it?
It's a boat. Anyway, it doesn't matter. It's a bad joke. Go on.
Oh, yeah. Okay. I mean, look, it is, you're right, probably his most accessible movie, and a lot of fun, and the cast are having a great time, and the characters relating to what John said, they see that as well. They kind of see the absurdity in what's happening. So it has this sort of inner kind of engine of comedy that carries it through. But yeah, I'd be more kind of sort of 3.5 than 4.
But we're going to round it up to 4.
Round it up to 4.
Which is what we gave it. 4 stars for Free Fire. It is a lot of fun. Ghost in the Shell.
Yeah.
Is next. The adaptation of the classic, influential Matrix spawning 1995 anime.
Let's be honest here. We're all friends, right?
Yeah.
Associates. We didn't expect a lot, did we, from this film? We were a bit like, okay, the whitewashing scandal with Scarlett Johansson being cast as the Japanese character from the original manga anime was controversial enough, but it just felt like, could this film be anything other than not great? It just, I don't know. But going in and watching it, kind of a pleasant surprise. I thought it was visually pretty thrilling. We watched it on IMAX in 3D. I kind of hate 3D, but it really is. And it is like, it is a digital feast. There is so much CG going on. But it almost wears that as a kind of merit, in a sense, as a virtue, because you kind of subsumed. It's almost like watching Tron. You're subsumed in this kind of futuristic Tokyo cityscape. There's an earlier and really fantastic action sequence in which the Major, Scarlett Johansson's character, she's been kind of rebirthed within this shell, within this sort of cybernetic body, supposedly the soul of a refugee who's died in an incident previously, and she's trying to find her identity. But you pick her up after she's been doing this kind of like policing work, because she's starting to fray a bit, she's starting to age, which is quite interesting that she's losing her effectiveness. But it takes you right up through the city, holograms, a bit Blade Runner-y, and puts you on top of this building, and then the camera swoops down, and you feel this lurch in your stomach. It's kind of thrilling. I liked a lot about the sort of the world that he created. Less successful Rupert Saunders, of course. Yeah, whose previous effort was Snow White and the Huntsman, which was not brilliant.
Franchise spawner.
Yeah.
Until the franchise is spawned.
Yeah.
Spawned a franchise killer.
Yeah. Yep. This one, though, is it's nothing. I mean, it's nothing that we haven't seen 1,000 times in a variety of masterful sci-fi.
Isn't this the John Carter dilemma, where John Carter is an adaptation of something that spawned loads and loads of copycats, and then by the time the adaptation comes along, it looks like it's copying what it spawned?
A bit, yeah. I mean, you know, Blade Runner was obviously not necessarily influenced by that.
Yeah, of course.
But of that time. And so it all feels like a bit of a soup now, because you've watched Total Recall, you've watched, you know, you've seen AI or Gattaca or Blade Runner, or, you know, Minority Report was a film I thought about quite a lot watching this. Mm-hmm. And it's not got that level of craft or heart or soul to it. Mm-hmm. And seeing as it's a film about the human soul, that would be a flaw, I would say. But you're right, it doesn't probably reach back enough to the original and make you think, okay, there's something interesting happening that's connecting it back to its original kind of DNA, maybe. But as a visual kind of evening out, it's decent, I would say. And I think a lot of people have been surprised by kind of how well done it is. We've given it 3 stars.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't go any higher, but I wouldn't go any lower either.
3 stars for that, and 3 stars also for a horror film which is out this week called The Void, which I reviewed. And I like this film. I like this film a lot. I'm kind of thinking, why did I stop just short of giving it 4 stars? It's directed by first timers in terms of features anyway, Jeremy Gillespie and Stephen Kostansky, who I believe are art directors and makeup guys in their previous work, and they're still working on films right now. And it's a very low down and dirty, gore filled horror film that will really appeal to hardcore horror hounds, I feel, but it's something not quite there. It doesn't quite get to the finishing line for me. And it is ostensibly about a small town cop played by an actor called Aaron Poole, who is drawn into the night from hell. Essentially, he stumbles upon this guy who is injured, takes him, but doesn't know where he's come from, takes him to the local hospital, and there all hell literally breaks loose. There is a religious cult outside that appears out of nowhere with Ku Klux Klan-esque masks over their face, and they will not let people leave. They've got cleavers and machetes and all sorts of stuff, and the people inside the hospital realize that they're not alone, that there is some dark thing-esque creature which is stuck in the corridors of this hospital, and what does it want? And you know, it doesn't want nice things, that's for sure. And so the body count rises, the blood flows in great big gushing rivets of claret. So it's very, very interesting. It's a little bit derivative. It feels a lot like John Carpenter meets Lucio Fulci meets Clive Barker. There's really meets H.P. Lovecraft. There's huge, great big influences worn on its blood-soaked sleeve here, but it worked for me for the most part. But it, because of that derivation, I just thought, I'm not sure this is worth 4 stars. So 3 stars. But if you're really hardcore gore nut, then this might be a 4-star film for you. So there it is, The Void.
Sweet.
Do not avoid.
Very good.
Thank you. And that is it for this week's Empire Podcast in association with mustard.co.uk. Join us next week for more film-related fun, when Phil will be in the host's chair.
Will I?
You will.
Okay.
I wanted to wait until we were alone before I broke the news to you.
Hooray! Okay.
Yep. Nice. I'm not here. Helen's not here.
Right.
Yeah. So
Mick, the security guy's not here.
But good news, Phil's going to be in the host chair, and we'll you'll be in safe hands, and we'll be joined by Riz Ahmed, which is exciting. John, you did that, didn't you?
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's great.
He's great. So there you go. Something to look forward to. Until then, it is goodbye from next week's host.
Goodbye. I'm preparing.
Please do it in that voice. That would be amazing. It's goodbye from John.
Goodbye.
And it's goodbye from me. I'm off to write the script for Unlandable 2, :upgrade, holding pattern, with Carl Weathers, ... and Halle Berry. Ooh, exciting times. See you next time. Bye.